Okay, so as you may recall from Kip's talk, one of the goals of LIGO 3 is to push well beyond the standard quantum limit. So let me remind you that the standard quantum limit represents the minimum achievable noise with standard interferometers, and it arises as a direct consequence of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Now, we've already seen that the standard quantum limit can be surpassed if we use quantum non-demolition techniques. Yanbei's talk gave one example of that. There are a variety of other ideas on how to beat the standard quantum limit with quantum non-demolition, including this idea that I'm going to be talking about, which is to measure the speed of the test masses directly without collecting any position information. So I'll explain how doing this allows us to beat the standard quantum limit. Then once people figured out that this was a good idea, the next challenge was figuring out how to build a device that would actually do this. The first people to figure that out were Braginsky and Khalili, and their design involved microwave resonator. The design I'll be talking about is just the optical analog of that device that they designed. Now, to understand this speed meter, let's first take a closer look at the standard quantum limit. So in a position meter, we measure the position of the test masses. So let's suppose we take one such measurement with accuracy delta x1. Then, according to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, we're going to get a kick in the momentum. And this kick is of order Planck's constant over this uncertainty in the position. This change in the momentum is going to affect the future position of the test masses. So if we wait for a period of time and we measure the position again, then the accuracy of that second measurement is going to be constrained by this momentum kick that we got from our first measurement. So delta x2 is of order the kick in the momentum times the time we waited divided by the mass of the test mass. So then we do a little algebra, and we get this expression. And we can see from here that the best we can do on one measurement without messing up the other one is for these two quantities here to be equal. And so that's what the standard quantum limit is. It's just the balance in accuracy between these two measurements. For LIGO 2, that works out to be about 10 to the minus 19 meters. Now let's compare this to what happens in the speed meter. Here we're measuring the velocity of the test mass directly. This is equivalent to measuring the momentum, because velocity and momentum are just directly proportional. So according to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, when we make this velocity measurement, we're going to get a kick in the position. However, this doesn't matter, because we're only interested in the speed. If there's just some offset, that's not going to affect the future momentum of the test mass. So in this case, we simply are not constrained by the standard quantum limit. It just doesn't arise. And for this reason, velocity and momentum are sometimes called quantum non-demolition observables. So this explains why we can beat the standard quantum limit with a speed meter. So now let's look at how the speed meter works. Okay, so here's our interferometer. The first thing to notice is that the test mass that was here in the standard LIGO configuration has now been moved down here. Similarly, the mass that was over here is now over there. This thing here that used to be a beam splitter is now a highly reflective mirror. So we're left with two L-shaped cavities, one here and then one over there. And these are weakly coupled oscillators. Now, weakly coupled oscillators have a couple of interesting properties. One such property is that if you drive one, the other one gets excited. So we drive the laser in here into cavity two. Cavity one gets excited. All the light builds up over here. Another interesting property of weakly coupled oscillators is that if you have one cavity excited like this, then this light will gradually bleed over into the other cavity and come back. This sloshing has a characteristic frequency, big omega, which is the speed of light times the power square root of the power transmissivity of this mirror divided by the length of the cavities. So now we can use these properties to get our velocity signal. So we have our system running. Cavity one is excited. We move this mirror a little bit. That's going to put a phase shift on the light in cavity one. Let's call that phase shift alpha. Now, if we assume that we're only driving the cosine quadrature, then what that phase shift does is it starts to drive light into the sine quadrature in cavity one. So we get this buildup in the sine quadrature that will bleed over into cavity two and come back. When it comes back, it's 180 degrees out of phase compared to how it started. So that's just another property of weakly coupled oscillators. So now if we assume that we made this initial movement and then this mirror stays fixed, then the light in cavity one continues to have phase shift alpha. And so during this cycle of sloshing, there's still more light being driven into the sine quadrature with phase alpha in cavity one. So when the sloshed light gets back, these two things are out of phase and they cancel. And so we've just lost our information. But that's okay because that was the position information and we want the velocity. So if we now let this mass continue to move during this sloshing cycle, then by the time the slosh light gets back, the phase shift in cavity one has now changed a little bit. We have alpha plus delta alpha. So this time, we don't get complete cancellation. We're left with this little bit of phase shift. And that phase shift, delta alpha, is directly proportional to the velocity. So that's basically how this speed meter works. Now, I should mention that I've made a couple of assumptions in this kind of simplified argument. I have assumed that the sloshing is fast compared to the gravitational wave frequency, and I've assumed that the extraction of the signal out of this port here is very slow. As it turns out, neither one of these assumptions is valid for our purposes. So we have to make a few concessions to reality. So the first thing we do here is, since we don't want to wait forever to get our signal out, we have to take it out of this port a little bit faster. But that's going to cause some light to build up here in cavity two. That's not a good thing because that's going to cause position information to appear in our output. So the way we can deal with that is we can put a little bit of light into this port such that it will go over and cancel out anything that tries to build up into cavity two. So we can deal with that problem. The next thing is that for maximum sensitivity, we need the gravitational wave frequency and the sloshing frequency to be roughly equal. That's going to cause our output, which used to be pure velocity, to consist of all odd time derivatives of position. So that needs to be taken into account in the data analysis. Now, the third thing I want to talk about here is that one speed meter, one pair of cavities, is equivalent to a single arm in the standard LIGO configuration. Now, in principle, you can use a single arm, a single Fabry-Perot cavity, as a gravitational wave detector. What you would need to do is you take the light coming out of that Fabry-Perot cavity and interfere it with light that's fresh from your laser. Now, as long as the laser is perfectly stable in its frequency, that's fine, that'll work. But real lasers are not quite that perfect. So by having two arms, when we recombine the light, we're interfering light that was emitted from the laser at the same time, and therefore is the same frequency. So by the same argument, we need two speed meters here. So now let's look at the bottom line, the noise curve. Okay, so here, the green curve is the conventional LIGO 2 noise curve, and that's just the position meter. And as you can see, it just reaches the standard quantum limit, which is this dotted line. The blue curve is the LIGO 2 with signaling recycling, so that should look familiar from some of the previous talks today. And then, finally, this red curve on the bottom is the speed meter curve. And as you can see, it beats the standard quantum limit over a wide range of frequencies by a factor of about 4. Now, the one big problem with this design is that it requires very high laser powers. It depends somewhat on the transmissivities that you choose, but in preparing this graph, my circulating power was about 50 megawatts. which is a serious problem because that can deform your mirrors. So we are working on ways to try to bring that down to a more reasonable level. And Braginski and Khalili and their group is working on other techniques to beat the standard quantum limit by a significant amount with significantly lower laser power. So, thank you.
Okay, questions for Patricia?
Is it portable in California?
Yeah. Just, you just have a nuclear with longer storage time just to speed meter and then the only one, because then you'd be interfering at the people we can hear.
To have a longer what?
Have a longer storage time than speed meter.
I suppose you could do that. One of the other advantages to having two speed meters is, you know how in the conventional LIGO arm, you know, this arm gets stretched and that arm gets shrunk, and so you kind of double your signal. The same kind of thing will work here. So that noise curve will move up by a factor of two, and you're still operating at 50 megawatts. So,
might say with regard to the power, the circulating power is 50 megawatts here. It's 1 megawatt in LIGO 2. That's because you are building up it up in resonances in a cavity and then a subcavity. LIGO 2 operates with a basic laser that runs 180 watts. And if you use the same mirrors in LIGO 2, and in LIGO 3 you'll have better mirrors, but if you use LIGO 2 mirrors, so you increase from 180 watts to 10 kilowatts for the basic input line. So if you're not breaking the bank in your power bills to the generators in Texas.
There are no other questions. First of all, I'd like to remind the speakers, please speak Doug Early over there. If you have talks on transparency, aside from that, I'd like to thank all the speakers again and go to break.